This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents How to Be an Adult in Relationships, The 5 Keys to Mindful Loving by David Rico.
Introduction. These are lines from a poem by Sir John Suckling. To have loved alone will not suffice unless we have been wise and have our loves enjoyed. Love is the possibility of possibilities. Its farthest reach is beyond us, no matter how long we love or how much. It will always remain the mute mystery, to whose ecstasy and ache we can only surrender with a yes. There is something cheerful and plucky in us that lets us risk a journey into the labyrinth of love, no matter how hazardous. However, all of the love in the world will not bring us happiness or make a relationship work. That requires skill, and this skill is quite attainable. Practice can make us nimble enough to dance together with grace, however bashful we may be at the beginning. Love is experienced differently by each of us, but for most of us, 5 aspects of love stand out. We feel loved when we receive attention, acceptance, appreciation, and affection, and when we are allowed the freedom to live in accord with our own deepest needs and wishes. These 5 A's meet us in different guises throughout life's journey. In childhood, we need these 5 A's to develop self-esteem and a healthy ego. They are the building blocks of identity, of a coherent human personality. Human experience has a striking and reliable harmony. What we need for the building of a self is also precisely what we need for happiness in our adult love relationships. Intimacy at its best means giving and receiving the 5 A's, the joys and wealth of relationship. These 5 elements or aspects of love also describe our destiny of service to the world as mature spiritual beings. Great spiritual exemplars, such as Jesus or Buddha, can be seen as beings who offer this fivefold love to all of us. Through our spiritual practice, we come to know a power greater than our ego, and that power nourishes us by granting us the graces of attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. This is a touching and encouraging synchronicity built into our very being. The 5 A's are simultaneously the fulfillment of our earliest needs, the requirements of adult intimacy, and of universal compassion, and the essential qualities of mindfulness practice. In the splendid economy of human and spiritual development, the same keys open all our evolutionary doors. Thus, the 5 A's come to us as gifts in childhood. They are then bestowed by us as gifts to others. They are not the result of effort, but are the automatic overflow of love that we receive. We do not have to try. We simply notice that we are attentive, appreciative, and so forth toward those we love. The same applies to compassion. It is a spiritual gift, a grace bestowed on us as a result of mindfulness practice. It is not a task. We notice that compassion happens in us and through us as we become more mindfully present in the world. This compassion is shown by the 5 A's that are now 5 graces we receive and give. Is there a way to increase our capacity to give and receive these essential elements of love? Yes, we can do it through mindfulness, an alert witnessing of reality without judgment, attachment, fear, expectation, defensiveness, bias, or control. Through compassionate mindfulness, we become adept at granting the essential components of love to everyone, even to ourselves. And in the pages that follow, I will keep returning to mindfulness as the fast track to successful love. This book discusses each of the 5 A's and how they apply to childhood, relationships, and spiritual maturity. It also suggests practices that can help you in resolving childhood issues in creating happier relationships and in becoming more spiritually conscious and compassionate. Indeed, the practices are stirred by a spiritual ambition with higher stakes, a more loving you with the world as your beneficiary. All this entails taking a journey together, a heroic one because it involves pain and forces you to shift from a focus on ego to a focus on facing the risks of life together. This book walks you along that path, providing the kind of gear you will need to camp out together, safely and enjoyably. We will use both Western and psychological tools, Eastern and Western spiritual practices, not graduating from one to the other, but employing them simultaneously. The main psychological tools are working through personal and childhood conundrums with a commitment to identify, process, and resolve issues so that you can change and grow. The spiritual tools are letting go of ego, increasing mindfulness, and cultivating an ethic of compassion. We achieve mindfulness when reality takes precedence over our ego. That is why mindfulness leads to intimacy, the mutual egoless gift of love. Couples with a spiritual practice have a greater serenity in their life together and increase their chances for happiness and longevity in their relationships. A relationship can force us to revisit every feeling and memory in the legend of ourselves. In our psychological work of addressing, processing, and resolving emotional blocks and problems, we pay attention to feelings, explore their implications, and hold them until they change or reveal a path that leads deeper into ourselves. In our spiritual practice of mindfulness, something very different occurs. We let feelings or thoughts arise and let go of them. We do not process them, nor do we hold them. Each of these approaches has its proper time, and we need both of them. Paying attention and letting go are the twin tools that will be presented throughout these pages. Therapy without mindfulness takes us only to the point of resolving our predicament. Mindfulness with therapy helps us to dissolve the ego that got us into it in the first place. The heroic journey is a metaphor for the yearning in the human soul for something that can repair and restore what has been broken or lost in our limited world. The journey of the hero or heroine involves first a leaving of the familiar, then a passage through struggle to a new place, and finally a return home with the gift of higher consciousness that is available to all who want it. Two people find each other in romance and oppose each other in conflict, only to engage finally in a life commitment to one another. It seems we cannot love maturely unless we go through the full itinerary of just such a risky expedition. But this Western metaphor is incomplete without mindfulness. In short, we need to get up and go, but we also need to sit and stay. By taking a journey without meditation and silence, we might fall prey to a restricting and extroverted activism. By practicing meditation without a sense that we are on a journey, we might fall prey to an introverted quietism. The Eastern voice tells us we are already here. The Western voice calls us to go out in order to get here fully. We arrive nowhere and are nowhere without that combination. Buddha did not sit forever, but went out into the world to spread the word. Jesus did not preach and heal every day, but sometimes sat in the desert alone. The human heart holds much more love than it can ever disperse in one lifetime. This book suggests a program for activating that abundant potential. Intimate love is enigmatic and demanding. Many of us fear it while still craving it. Thus, it definitely requires an extensive manual. This book explores the tender and scary territories of our psyche and blazes a path through them. It is not too late or too long for any of us. I am writing as a psychotherapist on a Buddhist path and as a man with a checkered relationship history. I have met with many problems and have found some ways to deal with them. I have discovered that they are not bottomless pits, but portals to a richer life. My accent in this book is necessarily on how we get stuck and how things go wrong, but you can also trust me to show ways to make things work better and ways the whole experience can make us better people and create a better world. Enlightenment can only be embodied in the world by people who love one another. So relationships are not about how two people can survive each other, but about how the whole world becomes more capable of love with all its dim anguish and glowing rapture. The work and practice I recommend here are not aimed at making your life together smoother, but at helping you relate to its inevitable roughness with humor, ease, and generosity. An untamed ego cannot pull that off. Only an awakened heart can do it. Then intimacy is best approached on a spiritual path. As a bonus, our limited personal work can heal the wider world. I hope this book will pose poignant questions like these and help you answer them. What will it take for me to find the happiness I always wanted? Will I feel loved the way I always wanted to be loved? What will it take for me to let go of the past? Will I learn to protect my boundaries, insist that others honor them, and honor those of others? Will I ever let go of the need to be in control? Will I ever dare to love with all my heart? This whole book is a letter from me to you. I am eager to share with you what I have learned from clients, friends, and from my own life. At the same time, the book will elicit information from you, not just give information to you. The truths of love and how it works are deeply and enduringly known by you and every person, always and already. My part has only been to type into this apple the wisdom that came to me from Eden and its exiles. Part 1, The Home We Leave. A quotation from Milarepa, a Tibetan Buddhist saint. To leave home is half the Buddhist teaching. Chapter 1, How It All Began. A quotation from Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. Man is a giddy thing. We are born with the capacity to dance together, but not with the necessary training. We have to learn the dance steps and practice until we move with ease and grace. The joy in it requires work. Some of us have been damaged physically or in our self-confidence, and we will have to practice dancing more than others. Some of us have been so damaged, we may never be able to dance well at all. Some of us were taught it was a sin to dance. It is exactly the same in relationships. Our early experience forms or deforms our adult relationships. As children, some of us were so injured or disabled psychologically by neglect, inhibition, or abuse, that it may take us years of work and practice before we can dance a graceful adult commitment. Some of us were so abused that we feel compelled to abuse others in revenge. Some of us were so damaged in the past that we may never be able to relate in an adult way. Most of us, however, had good enough parenting, reasonable fulfillment of our emotional needs, for attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing, the 5 A's. And so in adulthood, we are reasonably facile at relating to others in healthy ways. This means relating mindfully, without either blind possessiveness or a crippling fear of closeness. Yet no one relates with perfect ease without learning the skill, just as no one dances with perfect ease without instruction. Some people master dancing and others never quite get it right, though perhaps others do not fully notice. A relationship likewise may look successful, but it may not be providing true intimacy or commitment, a real problem if it has led to marriage and children, or to any committed relationship. As dancers, we can refuse to improve our skill with little consequence to anyone else. But if we do the same thing in a relationship, someone may get hurt. Relationship in this context means intimate involvement while living either together or apart. Then there are those of us who suffered serious childhood abuse and lack of need fulfillment, and thereby were damaged in such a way that we cannot easily be intimate. In time, we too may learn to relate intimately, but only if we work through our early issues. It is our responsibility to expend the energy it will take to practice and become successful at relating well. It does not come automatically. We will have to learn, be taught, grieve our past, work in therapy, get to know our true self, undo years of habits, practice with a partner, follow a spiritual practice, and read and work with a book like this. The good news is that we, like all human beings, have a psyche calibrated to do that work. Eventually, the awkwardness and missteps give way to harmonious and cooperative movement that reflects the love song behind it all. We have heard about the harm our childhood wounds can do to our adult relationships, but I take a generally positive view of the childhood phase of our human journey. What happened to us then is not as important as how we hold it now. Positively as something we have grown by, or negatively as something that goes on wounding us and our relationships. If we can mourn the past and thereby diminish its impact on our present lives, we can then maintain our boundaries while still bonding closely to a partner. As long as we have a program for dealing with adversity, no problem can lead us to despair. We have heard people being labeled codependent when they cannot leave a painful relationship that has no future. Yet our sense of self is radically embedded in our negotiations with our original family members. If a relationship reconfigures an original bond with our father or mother, leaving it may pose a terrifying threat to our inner security. Then all prospects of change, even for the better, represent a threat. We are challenged to be compassionate toward ourselves for the time it takes to make changes. Taking our time does not have to mean we are cowardly or codependent. Only that we are sensitive to pressures and meanings from regions of our psyche still in the grip of an old regime. Our failed and failing bonds have preoccupied us all our lives, but to repeat is human, to reframe is healthy. As we replace, however slowly, defensive reactions with different ways of doing things, new capacities open and new skills come into play in our relationships. It is not only a matter of breaking out of the enclosing arc of childhood. We humans require the animating sustenance of our fellows. We have to know that an echoing or enthusiastic resonance to our unique existence is available somewhere in this vast and ravaged world. We cannot make that happen on our own, but we can be open to it and welcome it. If we found total satisfaction in childhood, we would have no motivation to reach out to the wider world. The journey of adulthood begins when we leave, as we must, the secure nest provided by father and mother, and try to find a partner in the adult world. Without such a need, we might be seduced by the comfort of home, isolate ourselves from the larger world, and thus never find our unique place in it. This also explains why no person or thing will ever be enough to satisfy the full breadth of our human potential. Nature cannot afford to lose any of her stewards. So she has calibrated the heart so it is never permanently fulfilled. But she does grant moments of satisfaction with things and with people, and they can sustain us. Once that happens, we have found ourselves. This was expressed so touchingly by the character of the knight in Ingmar Bergman's film, The Seventh Seal. He said, "I shall remember this hour of peace, the strawberries, the bowl of milk, your faces in the dusk. I shall remember our words, and shall bear this memory between my hands as carefully as a bowl of fresh milk, and this will be a sign of great contentment." Love from another adult does more than just satisfy us in the present. It works into the future. And it also ripples back in time for us, repairing, restoring, and renovating an inadequate past. Sincere love also sets off a forward-moving ripple and a resultant shift inside us. We get to the point at which we can think, "Now I don't have to need quite so much. Now I don't have to blame my parents quite so much. Now I can receive love without craving more and more. I can have and be enough." Only the person whose journey has progressed to that point can love someone intimately. A holding environment, the safe and reliable context of the five A's, is necessary for all growth, both psychological and spiritual. We are like kangaroos developing in a pouch. We experience being held within the womb, within the family, within a relationship, within support groups, and within civic and spiritual communities. At every stage of our lifespan, our inner self requires the nurturance of loving people who are attuned to our feelings and responsive to our needs. They are the ideal sources that foster our inner resources of personal power, lovability, and serenity. Those who love us understand us and are available to us with an attention, appreciation, acceptance, and affection we can feel, and they make room for us to be who we really are. Our work, then, is to become the healthiest possible version of who we uniquely are. The healthy ego, what Freud called a coherent organization of mental processes, is the part of us that can observe self, situations, and persons, assess them, and respond in such a way as to move toward our goals. We do not let go of this aspect of ego, but build on it. It assists us in relationships by making us responsible and sensible in our choices and commitments. The neurotic ego, on the other hand, is the part of us that is compulsively driven or stymied by fear or desire. Feeding arrogance, entitlement, attachment, and the need to control other people. Sometimes it is self-negating and makes us feel that we are victims of others. This neurotic ego is the one we are meant to dismantle as our spiritual task in life. Its tyrannies frighten intimacy away and menace our self-esteem. Western psychology places major importance on building a sense of self or ego. Buddhism, in contrast, places major importance on letting go of the illusion of a freestanding, fixed, solid self. These views seem contradictory until we realize that Buddhism presupposes a healthy sense of self. It does not recommend abdicating the adult tasks of building competence and confidence, relating to others effectively, discovering life purpose, or fulfilling responsibilities. Indeed, we first have to establish a self before we can let go of one. That self is a provisional and convenient designation, but not ultimately real in any enduring, unchanging way. To say that there is no limited, fixed self is a way of referring to the boundless potential in each of us. Our enlightened mind, our enlightened nature. We can transcend our limited selves. We are more than what appears in our limited egos. Great mystics feel the oneness experienced in meditation as soothing at first, but then as a force propelling them into the world with a sense of service. This is why ours is an heroic or paradoxical journey. This does not mean that all of us have to live a life of constant service to humanity. That is a special calling requiring special graces. But we are fulfilled when we live out our personal capacity for loving. Our spiritual practice is perfect when we show love in every one of the unique and peerless ways that are in us. The Power of Mindfulness. A quotation by Mark Epstein. Meditation is not a means of forgetting the ego. It is a method of using the ego to observe and tame its own manifestations. Self-actualization is not a sudden happening or even a permanent result of long effort. The 11th century Tibetan Buddhist poet and saint Milarepa suggested, "Do not expect full realization. Simply practice every day of your life. A healthy person is not perfect but perfectible. Not a done deal, but a work in progress. Staying healthy takes discipline, work, and patience, which is why our life is a journey and, perforce, an heroic one. The neurotic ego wants to follow the path of least resistance. The spiritual self wants to reveal new paths. It is not that practice makes perfect, but that practice is perfect, because it combines our efforts with an openness to grace. Grace is a free gift of progress or awakening that comes to us unbidden and unconjured from deeply within our enlightened mind, our Buddha mind. Bread takes the effort of kneading, but also requires sitting quietly while the dough rises with a power all its own. We are not alone in our psychological or spiritual evolution. A higher power than ego, wiser than our intellect, and more enduring than our will, kicks in to assist us. Even now, as you're hearing this, many bodhisattvas and saints are gathering to become your mighty companions on your heart's path. Mindfulness is an elegant Buddhist practice that brings our bare attention to what is going on in the here and now. It does this by freeing us of our mental habit of entertaining ourselves with our ego-based fears, desires, expectations, evaluations, attachments, biases, defenses, and so on. The bridge from distractions back to the here and now is the physical experience of paying attention to our breathing. The classic sitting pose plays an important part in mindfulness by encouraging us to stay still and become centered physically. Furthermore, sitting is earth touching, and earth, because of its here and now concreteness, grounds and centers us in the face of compelling mental seductions. We sit as a practice for how we will act throughout the day. Mindfulness, however, is more than a meditation. It involves more than sitting. It is moment by moment non-clinging to ego, moment by moment calm presence in the simplicity that results when we experience reality without the clutter produced by the decorative arts of ego. The word mindfulness is actually a misnomer, since the act itself involves mind emptying, not mind filling. It is the only non-altered state of mind, the pure experience of our own reality. Meditation is the vehicle to mindfulness in all areas. Mindfulness meditation is not a religious event or a form of prayer. It is an exploration of how the mind works and how it can be stilled so as to reveal an inner spaciousness in which wisdom and compassion can arise with ease. Mindfulness is not meant to help us escape reality, but to see it clearly, without the blinding overlays of ego. Meditation is not escapism. Only the layers of ego are. To stay with that vision leads to letting go, while, ironically, escaping leads to holding on. In the haunted valley of human paradox, we gain and go on by losing and letting go. And mindfulness is the good shepherd within that helps that happen. In mindfulness, we do not repress or indulge any thoughts, only notice them and return to our breathing, gently guiding ourselves back to where we belong as a kindly parent does to a straying child. Meditation is entirely successful when we keep coming back to our breathing in a patient and non-judgmental way. Mindful awareness is the condition of the fair and alert witness, rather than the judge, jury, prosecutor, plaintiff, defendant, or defense attorney. We notice what happens in our minds and simply take it as information. That does not mean stoicism or indifference, because then we would lose our vulnerability, an essential component of intimacy. To witness is not to stand aloof, but to stand by. We then can act without compulsion or disquiet, relating to what is happening, rather than becoming possessed by it. There are two kinds of witnessing, compassionate and dispassionate. In compassionate witnessing, we observe from a loving perspective. It is like looking at photos in a family album. We are suffused with a kindly feeling and with no sense of grasping. We look and let go as we move on to what may appear on the next page. In dispassionate witnessing, on the other hand, we look with passive indifference. We are stolid and unmoved, with no expectancy for what comes next or appreciation of what has gone before. This is like looking at the scenery from a train window. We simply watch it go by without inner responsiveness. Mindful witnessing is compassionate witnessing, a committed presence free of fear and clinging. Mindfulness is watchfulness more than watching. We look at reality as custodians of its truth. Artist Sister Wendy Beckett says, "Great artists make great paintings because they have learned, quote, to look without fixed ideas of what is fitting," unquote. This is mindfulness. It can be either consciousness without content, that is, pure awareness, with no attention to any particular issue or feeling, or it can be consciousness with content, attention without ego intrusions, mindfulness. Generally, the latter style is the one I mean when I refer to mindfulness in this book. Mindfulness is thus a courageous venture because it is trusting that we have it in us to hold and tolerate our feelings, to grant them hospitality no matter how frightening they may seem, to live with them in equipoise. We then discover a strength within us that is the equivalent of self-discovery, and from that self-esteem comes effective relating with others. Because mindfulness leads us to let go of ego by letting go of fear and grasping, it is an apt tool for healthy relating. It makes us present to others purely without the buffers of the neurotic ego. We simply stay with someone as he is, noticing, not judging. We take what a partner does as information, without having to censure or blame. In doing this, we put space around an event, rather than crowding it with our own beliefs, fears, and judgments. Such mindful presence frees us from constricting identification with others' actions. A healthy relationship is one in which there are more and more such spacious moments. Mindfulness is a path to giving others the 5 A's, the essential components of love, respect, and support. The word mindfulness comes from Sanskrit words meaning attend and stay. Thus, we pay attention and we stay with someone in her feelings and in her here and now predicament. When I accept someone in this serene way, shifts occur in me and both of us begin to discover the skillful means to more appreciative affection and commitment. To accept is also the first step toward letting go of control and allowing freedom. Thus, This mindful acceptance is our working basis for relationships. The five A's are the results of and the conditions for mindfulness as applied to relationships. Mindfulness itself is inherent in human nature. We are built to pay attention to reality. Indeed, paying attention is a survival technique. Over the years, though, we learn to escape and take refuge in illusory sanctuaries built by an ego frightened of reality. We notice that it is easier to believe what will make us feel better, and we feel entitled to expect that others will be what we need them to be. These are the man-made chains that look like links to happiness. But once we commit ourselves to experience, divested of ego wishes and attachments, we begin to act straightforwardly, becoming truthful with one another. We relax into the moment, and it becomes a source of immense curiosity. We do not have to do anything. We do not have to search in our bag of ego toys for something with which to face the moment. We do not have to put our dukes up. We do not have to become the pawns of our fixations or our fixed conceptions of reality. We do not have to find a pigeonhole. We do not have to go on the defensive or devise a comeback. We can simply let things unfold, attending to reality as it is and staying through it as we are. This is a lot more relaxing than our habitual reactions, and we use the original equipments of the human psyche rather than the artificial contraptions, accent on trap, concocted by ego over the centuries. This is why mindfulness is also called waking up. At every stage of life, our inner self requires the nurturance of loving people, attuned to our feelings and responsive to our needs, who can foster our inner resources of personal power, lovability, and serenity. Those who love us understand us and are available to us with an attention, appreciation, acceptance, and affection that we can feel, and they make room for us to be who we are. Though it may sound odd to say so, mindfulness is itself a holding environment. When we sit, we are never alone, because all the saints and bodhisattvas, the enlightened beings who keep coming back to help us, all of those bodhisattvas, past and present, are with us. Meditating mindfully means contact and continuity with a long tradition. To sit is to be assisted and held. When Buddha sat on the earth, it was as if he sat in a lap, and it is the same for us. Mindfulness is being an adult. It is unattainable for someone who lacks inner cohesion, personal continuity, integration. Being a fair witness requires a healthy ego. Because distance and objectivity are unavailable to someone with poor boundaries, no tolerance of ambiguity, and no sense of a personal center. Meditation may be threatening to someone who is unstable and in need of mirroring. The reassuring and validating reflection of one's feelings by another person. The Buddha's ruthless commitment to acknowledging impermanence will be terrifying and destructive to someone without a firm foundation as a separate and autonomous and intelligently protected self. Finally, the call to live in the present comes at the wrong time for someone who needs first to explore the past and be free of its stubborn grip. This is why both psychological work for individuation and spiritual practice for egolessness will always be required as dual requisites for the enlightenment of beings as beautifully and mysteriously designed as we. Meditation is not to be attempted in any serious way if we are not psychologically ready for it. At the same time, we can begin with simple meditation daily as an adjunct to psychotherapeutic work. This book advocates working on the psychological and the spiritual simultaneously and in bite-sized chunks. This is based on the fact that some spiritual attitudes contribute to psychological health and vice versa. For instance, The spiritual attitude of acceptance helps us bear necessary and appropriate grief, while the psychological ability of assertiveness helps us stand up for justice for ourselves and others, and so increases our compassion. The Buddhist social activist and author Ken Jones says, quote, "Systems of maturation like Buddhism teach that it is only through unflinchingly facing our afflictions and opening unreservedly to our feelings that we can come to experience an empowerment that is other than this trembling self," unquote. And by self, he's referring to ego. When ego is deposed, mindfulness leads to the higher self, Jung's approximation of the Buddha mind, the enlightened qualities within us all. This self is unconditionally loving, perennially wise, and has healing powers, the very qualities that foster evolution. We are never without it. To find ourselves spiritually is to acknowledge our destiny to use our ego skills to serve the purposes of the higher self. Thus, we strive for intimacy with the whole universe, not just with one person. After all, we cannot expect from a partner what can only come from the self, universe, higher power. This is why pursuing our own spiritual path is so important to the health of a relationship. Mindfulness does not mean that we have no desires, simply that we are not possessed by them. We may feel fear and desire, but they no longer drive, shame, or stop us. Instead, we hold them without the elaborations our brain so habitually adds. We handle fear and enjoy desire and move past both of them with ease, like Ulysses, who heard the siren song and sailed on. As the Tibetan Buddhist teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said, "Go through it, give into it, experience it. Then the most powerful energies become absolutely workable rather than taking you over, because there is nothing to take over if you are not putting up any resistance." End of quotation. Can fathers provide the container for the holding and separating experience so crucial to growth? It seems unlikely. Their role is to protect us from being contained too long. Women can provide a safe place for us to express our feelings and make our unique choices. But men show us a safe exit into the larger world. And if fathers are sometimes so demanding that they undermine a developing child's freedom to be himself, this is where grandfathers can step in to give male nurturance mindfully, that is, without expectation or demand. We begin our lives in a containing womb, and then move to an embrace. Alchemy, the transformation of something into its opposite, also happens in a container. A vessel is required in which the lead of ego can be transformed into the gold of the higher self. Only then can the giant of fear be faced and conquered. Therapy or a support group might be an appropriate vessel when we face difficult transitions. Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, can play this role for someone moving from addiction into sobriety. Our identity cannot grow in isolation because we are dialogical by nature. The British psychiatrist D.W. Winnicott says, quote, "Only in the arms of someone can the first I am be pronounced, or rather risked," unquote. The original emotional needs of life were fulfilled in the holding environments of the womb, our nursing mother's arms, the warmth of our home, parental protection. These are the requisite locuses of serene development. In such a safe and embracing environment, children feel they are living in a folder of security that is also roomy enough for them to express their feelings freely. They believe their parents can handle their feelings and mirror them back with acceptance, love. In short, there is room for their true self at the end. If their needs are unmet, on the other hand, they may have difficulty trusting a higher power or acknowledging the need for spirituality in adult life. Higher power is my term for what I believe to be the perfect source of the five A's. Faith commitments call for trust in an invisible source of nurturance. And when visible sources of nurturance have let us down, we are less likely to trust the invisible ones. Yet Carl Jung says that the longing for the spiritual is as strong in us as the desire for sex. We are therefore ignoring an inner instinct when we totally deny the possibility of a power greater than ourselves. Another face of this same problem is religious fanaticism, a negative, abusive religiousness that is full of guilt and obligation. When we did not receive fulfillment in one or more of the five A's, a bottomless pit was created inside us. An unfulfillable yearning for the missing pieces of our puzzling and arid past. Mourning an unfulfilled childhood is painful. We fear grief because we know we will not be able to control its intensity, its duration, or its range. And so we look for ways around it. But engaging with our grief is a form of self-nurturance and liberation from neediness. Paradoxically, to enter our wounded feelings in our grief fully places us on the path to healthy intimacy. Is this my problem? Have I been afraid to grieve what I did not get from mom and dad, and so have demanded it from partners, strangers, and innocent bystanders? Am I unable to find it in myself because I have been investing all my energy in looking for it in someone else? To retrieve the past and to undo the past are our paradoxical goals in relationships. No wonder they're so complex. Their complexity is not about the transactions between two adults, but the fact that such transactions never really begin. Instead, two children are tugging at each other's sleeve, shouting in unison, "Look what happened to me when I was a kid. Make it stop. Make it better for me." In effect, we are asking an innocent bystander to repair a problem he has no knowledge of and little skill to repair. And all the time and energy that goes into that transaction distracts us from the first part of our work, to repair our own lives. The cold ground of our psyche is like a cryogenic laboratory where our unmet needs from childhood remain frozen in their original state, awaiting healing and fulfillment, usually without revealing to us the full extent to which we felt forlorn and bereft. The path to love begins in our own past and in its healing, and only then can move outward to relationships with others. Even if our childhood needs were met, we may still need to work on ourselves as adults. Nurturant parents make sure our childhood environment is safe and soothing, and as adults we may keep looking for the people or things that can recreate that miracle. The recurrent fantasy of or search for the perfect partner is a strong signal from our psyche that we have work to do on ourselves. For a healthy adult, there is no such thing as a perfect partner, except temporarily or even momentarily. No one source of happiness exists, nor can a partner make life perfect. The fact that this happens in fairy tales says it all. A relationship cannot be expected to fulfill all our needs. It only shows them to us and makes a modest contribution to their fulfillment. We can ask ourselves, could it be that I would not have learned what I needed to learn if I had met the perfect partner? The perfect partner is the mirage we see after crossing the desert of insufficient love. Mirages happen because we lack water. That is, we lack something we needed for a long time. They are normal, nothing to be ashamed of. We simply notice them, take them as information about where our work lies, and then we let them go. If we do this, we will come to the real oasis, nature's gift to those who keep going, who are not stopped by the mirage. Yet it is a given of life that nothing is permanently and finally satisfying. Despite this fact, many of us believe that somewhere there is a person or thing that will be permanently satisfying. Such a chimerical belief and the restless, desperate seeking that follows from it can become deeply disheartening and self-defeating. But in mindfulness, we can surrender to reality with all its impermanence and frustration. And from that position of surrender, something wonderfully encouraging can happen. We find that we want a partner who walks beside us in the world, not one we hope will change its givens or provide an escape hatch from them. We find a pleasing balance between surrendering to the given of the fundamental unsatisfactoriness of life, while at the same time maximizing our opportunity for contentment. This is our discovery of the felicitous pass between the snowy peaks of delusion and despair. From this point of view, moderate need fulfillment as sufficient, experienced in days or even just moments, Emily Dickinson, making every word count, call this, quote, a glow as intimate, as fugitive, as sunset on the snow. Moderate is the key word for giving and receiving the 5 A's. A non-stop flow of them would be quite annoying, even to an infant. Our fantasy mindset makes us long for just what we would soon flee. Hence, what seems like an unsatisfactory compromise is actually the adult's best deal. The hospitable sanctuary and the generous waters of an oasis can be enjoyed for one day or many, but not forever. Sooner or later, they will cloy, and our hearts will long for what comes next. The desert and what lies beyond it, whatever their mystery and hardship, beckon, and they cannot be evaded or renounced. Journeying is built into us, no matter how beautiful our home. The idea of change excites us no matter how pleasing our present circumstance. This may be what the poet George Herbert meant by the lines in which God says of the newly created Adam, yet let him keep the rest, but with repining restlessness, let him be rich and weary. The 5 A's, the keys that open us. We know deep down and have always known that need fulfillment and good parenting mean receiving the 5 A's, attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. As children, we noticed how our parents did or did not fit the bill. We then looked for someone who could fit the bill better or more consistently. This process is like looking at a reproduction of the Mona Lisa, but noticing it is blurred and the color is not right. We know how it should look, and we keep our eye out for a sharper print with brighter color. As adults, we look for the partner who will be just right. At first, this means a replica of our parents, with some of the better or missing features added. So we find the man who controls but is also loyal. As we mature, we no longer seek the negative traits, only the positive ones. So we no longer look for controlling men, but for loyal men who let us be ourselves. In full maturity, we do not demand perfection at all, only notice reality. We access our resources within. A partner who cooperates in that is a gift, but no longer a necessity. The 5 A's begin as needs to be fulfilled by our parents, then become needs to be fulfilled by our partners, and someday become the gifts we give to ourselves and to the world. Because we are dialogical beings, our self-esteem emerges from contact with others who provide us with the 5 A's. These 5 A's are not extras. They are the components of the healthy, individuated ego. Attention from others leads to self-respect. Acceptance engenders a sense of being inherently a good person. Appreciation generates a sense of self-worth. Affection makes us feel lovable. Allowing gives us the freedom to pursue our own deepest needs, values, and wishes. When the five A's were not forthcoming, we might have felt we were to blame. That may leave us with a gnawing need to make reparation all our life. Such reparation is futile and misleading, since the true task is a journey out into the world to find some of what was missing, and then to discover it in ourselves too. We feel something missing when we speak and do not receive attention, show ourselves and are not accepted, ask for love and are not held, make a choice and are not allowed to pursue it. In contrast, when others grant us the five A's, we feel fulfilled and at ease within ourselves. An adult can unabashedly ask for the A he needs if it is not freely offered. He is only asking for what it takes to achieve the commencement of full humanness. That tender and ever so gingerly ventured bid to be loved is precisely what makes us humans so lovable. Nature never intended us to find all we needed from two individuals, our biological parents. Indeed, one or both might have died or left us, leaving holes inside. But we were endowed with sockets too. These are the archetypes of mother and father, innate receptacles in our psyches for mother and father energies, and these can be filled by stand-ins. The aunt or uncle, the older sibling, the grandparent, the minister, the teacher, or anyone offering even one of the five A's will do. No set of parents is sufficient to fulfill our parenting needs, no matter how nurturant they may be. It is necessary and healthy to receive need fulfillment from other sources all through life. An archetypal longing encourages us to keep an eye out for those who offer it. An adult sensibility releases us from expecting any person to fulfill it totally. In addition, in an adult relationship, as in childhood, the expression of the five A's changes throughout the relationship. A mother shows attention differently to a 12-year-old than to a 1-year-old. A partner shows a different kind of attention in the conflict phase of a relationship than in the romance phase. To expect everything to remain the same is to miss the analogy between adult relating and growing up. The quality and the amount of all the graces of love change with time. This is not because lovers are less generous in what they offer, but because they are more conscious of ever-shifting needs and resources. The five A's are the essential ingredients of love, respect, security, and support. In addition, they form the essence of spiritual practice, what we cultivate in meditation and on the path of compassion. The practices in this book suggest techniques and insights to bring meditative awareness and compassion to our relationships. These suggestions are not strategies to stay together, but keys to the practice of love, our life purpose, and our fulfillment. Indeed, we stand to gain so much when we show the five A's. They are given to others, but all of them make us more loving as we give them. They are therefore the components of building the virtue of love in ourselves. To love is to become loving. We now look at each of the five A's in turn. First, attention. And I begin with a quotation by the British psychiatrist D.W. Winnicott. "It is a joy to be hidden, but a disaster not to be found." Every mammal feels instinctively that it needs and deserves full parental attentiveness. When a parent is only halfway attentive, the child notices and feels uneasy. The mother leopard does not have her mind on her grooming while she is feeding her young. Nor does she demand that her young groom her and wait for their dinner. Her single-minded attention gives them healthy priorities later in life. Children's psychic life becomes confused if they have to take care of a parent or make sense of one, because that is the reverse of what children instinctively